I get it. You didn't click the link to listen to ads, so I'll be quick. I love coaching clinics. Whether I'm speaking at one or simply just attending, I love listening to coaches talk about how they do things while having the opportunity to connect with new coaches. At the same time, I have been able to connect with coaches all over the world through apps like Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And so many times I've had conversations with coaches and thought, I wish I could share this with other coaches. But then I had another thought. In the year 2020, why should a coach have to wait a couple months for the next great coaching clinic? If they're eager to learn, why can't we just put content at their fingertips? So we created the Film Room. The Film Room is our online education system for coaches that is designed to have everything in one place, from individual skill development and team drills to set plays and offensive and defensive systems. Our platform is a one-stop shop for coaches of all levels. And best of all, it's free with literally no strings attached. For more information, visit basketballcatalyst.com/filmroom. Welcome back to The Drawing Board. I'm your host, Reed Osi, and today we're going to talk with Steve D'Agostino. Steve created and developed Dags Basketball in the Albany, New York area, and has grown the company into one of the biggest and best on the East Coast. He works with USA Basketball and currently trains many of the top players in the Albany area, as well as Kevin Herter of the Atlanta Hawks. We really honed in on development and what goes into that, and while our playing careers couldn't be any different, we have many similarities in terms of the work ethic that was instilled in us from an early age. So I think you're going to enjoy this. Here's Steve D'Agostino. All right, I'd like to welcome on Steve D'Agostino. Now, Steve, obviously want to do right by you and give you a formal introduction. But back when I was in college, I had a roommate whose name was Taylor Swanson, but we called him Swanee. And then when he started dating his wife, she would call him Taylor. And we had no idea who he was. We're like, who are you talking about? And I'm not sure I've actually ever heard anyone refer to you as Steve. So Dags is pretty iconic. You're up there with Michael, Kobe, Madonna.
Let's just stay with Dags, man. One name, that's it.
I love it. Well, I do appreciate you coming on. You know, obviously we talked through player development stuff before, but when I decided to dig deeper into your background for this interview or this podcast, you know, I stumbled across the fact that your family has had a concrete product business that's almost 100 years old.
Yeah, they've been in business since 1922. We manufacture concrete products, so like pavers, retaining walls, architectural block, which I'm sure like where you guys are from, there's a lot of the schools are made out of architectural block and stuff like that too. Yeah, I grew up working there, man. I started working when I was like 12 with my grandfather picking weeds, and then graduated to like stacking pallets of block, which was like the worst thing you could ever think about doing, you know? And so I worked there up until I was like about 20 or so, like midway through college. And then, so it was good. Taught me a lot of life lessons starting to work that early, you know?
Totally. And it immediately jumped off the page to me because I grew up on a farm in Minnesota, and I would attribute a lot of who I am today to that experience.
Yeah, 100%.
And I bring that up because I want to transition and talk a little bit from your high school to college transition. You know, you're undersized, you're under-recruited, they don't think you're big enough or good enough. You know, we talk about your growth growing up, working in the concrete industry, things like that, and kind of having a chip on your shoulder.
Yeah.
When I bring up that time in your life, what comes to mind?
Yeah, it's typical, man. Like, especially for someone who's under 6 foot, you know, by the time I was in eighth grade. So my dad was a high school coach and he's been a high school coach in our area, upstate New York, for, you know, as long as I can remember. My brother was 2 years older than me. He was going to go to Division III Clarkson. He was all set to go there and then had a chance to walk on at Iona, right outside of New York City. And he knew he wanted to be a head coach. So he thought that, you know, going to Iona and playing for Coach Jeff Ruland, who was a legend down there, played in the NBA, would give him the best track to like be a coach. So that's what he ended up doing. So, you know, I had people in front of me that, you know, were doing the basketball thing. But by the time I was in eighth grade, man, I was I don't even think I was 5 foot in eighth grade. So I knew, okay, I have to do I got to really commit to this. I got to do it every day. And this was before like it was cool to work out. Like not everybody was working out. You'd go to like a big camp, you'd go to like a five star or something like that. And the coaches would be like, the most important day after camp is the next day. Make sure you're doing stuff, right? So that kind of got me rolling and going. So in eighth grade, I'm like, listen, I'm just going to work out every single day. I'm going to try to learn as much as I can. I'm going to play hard, all that good stuff. And wherever I end up, I end up. So, eighth grade, I was 4'10". Ninth grade, I was 5'3". 10th grade, I was 5'6", like 120 pounds. Made our varsity team. Was basically just like jacking up threes like a
I
maniac, you
love
know. And then so, I just kept getting better and better. And, by the time I was a varsity player, I'd played for the City Rocks, which is the Nike EYBL team. I was like 21 points, 5 assists a game. I led our school to like 21-3 record in the highest classification in New York State. And what had happened, and again, I was 5'11", 135 pounds, had shaggy hair. So I would send my highlight film, and back then you had to do it on like a VCR. Like I had like an actual tape that I would send. So we sent that out, sent a resume out. Actually, my dad sent it to every Division I school in the Northeast and every Division II school in the Northeast. So that's like three separate conferences. And literally the only school to reply was the one in our hometown, the College of St. Rose. And they were even like initially were like, hey, we can give you a partial scholarship, this and that. And so it wasn't until another school came in to offer me a full scholarship that St. Rose offered me a full and I accepted. But through that whole process, it's interesting too, and I like to tell this story, and because it's helped me out, and I don't think there's like enough of it on the college level from college coaches, is I remember getting two letters back from sending out my recruiting stuff. One was from American University, and it was basically just like, we don't think that you're good enough to play here. And I was like, okay, like that's like the truth, man. That hurts, And then the other one was Binghamton University, which is in the America East. And they were basically like, listen, we like you, but we recruit Atlantic 10 type players who don't end up going to Atlantic 10 schools and who end up falling for us. Good luck in your search. So I'm like, okay, at least they had like a reason, whatever. So fast forward to fall of my freshman year, coach comes in the locker room, like, guys, our first exhibitions in a month and a half, we're playing Binghamton. Like,
Yes.
awesome, cool. So they have a kid, they have a guy, 7 footer, Nick Billings was his name. He was a stud. He was on all the draft boards preseason or pre like his senior season. Our center was 6'2". He's a beast. His name's Adonis Barber. Had like the quickest second jump and tap game that you've like ever seen. Dude, we end up going to Binghamton. We beat him. I had like 7 points, 3 assists. I came off the bench, whatever. And the guy that they had taken in front of me, Mike Gordon was the kid's name, was a good player, but like didn't really do much. And so I'm sitting there after the game, I'm like, wait a second. They recruited all freaking Atlantic 10 players, and we're like a Division II school, and we're coming in here and beating them. And that's when like, your wheels start turning. You're like, you start understanding that there's levels to this, and we ended up, we beat them twice. We beat them twice. We beat them like 2 years later too. And like they would never play us again. So that kind of ended that. But that was kind of my beginnings of high school into college.
Well, I remember when I lived on Long Island, I worked with a guy named Chris Johnson who played at Lemoyne.
Yeah.
And
He
so,
hit the shot, man.
yeah. So they're playing Syracuse. And wasn't
Yep.
Syracuse ranked top 25?
I forget if that's a year like they went on like the big run, right, and made it to like the Final Four. I can't
Yeah.
remember if that was a year or not.
Yeah. So Lemoyne's actually in Syracuse, right?
Yep.
Yeah. So Chris would tell this story, and I actually remember watching it.
Yeah.
Like, top 25 Syracuse team gets
Yeah.
beat by a Division II school in the same town.
Yep.
And I don't even think he was supposed to take the shot. Actually, I think his coach was like, hey, swing it. And
Yeah.
he's like, nah, I'm pulling.
Yeah.
But
Yeah.
they would go play open gym in the fall or the summer. And he went to
Yeah.
Syracuse, and they were like, screw you, get out of here.
Right.
And I think
Right.
the story goes is it was like downpouring, and he was forced to walk back in the rain.
Oh
And
my
knowing
God.
Chris and how feisty he is, I love the dude. But he was so pissed, like, this
Right.
will never happen again.
Right.
So he hits
Right.
the shot, and great story, D2 guy knocking him off. But it reminds me of, you know, I'm watching this video the other day, and it's of an entrepreneur named Tom Bilyeu. He has Quest Nutrition and Impact Theory, and he's telling a story of how he proposed to his wife. And his father-in-law, who became a mentor, was basically raised in the dirt in a village in Greece, ends up making millions of dollars while Tom is broke and unsure of what he wants to do. Yet he believes whatever he's going to do, he's going to be successful in. So I think you know where the story's going. And he asks the dad if he can propose to his daughter. And not only does he say no, but he just gets absolutely grilled. Yet what sticks out to me is he said that his father-in-law gave him the greatest gift he had ever received, which was the gift of doubt. And I'm listening to that, and I'm like, holy smokes. It blew me away because I realized that, you know, we refer to it as having a chip on our shoulder.
Yeah.
But in reality, it was the gift of doubt. And I had been given that more times than I could count.
Exactly. And so, like, you know, we've experienced that, but like now it goes to, let's just get into it with like youth basketball, right? I say this all the time. Are we taking away teachable moments for kids? Because I can point to like, 10 to 15 to 20 different scenarios where, like, I just had one the other day. My high school coach, my junior year, I had like a week stretch where I was horrendous. I think I was averaging like 17 points a game. I think one game I had 0 points. The next game I had 2 points. And in that second game of the week, I had missed like a couple shots in a row. Maybe they were quick. He lit me up.
Yeah.
Our leading scorer, best player, lit me up. This isn't the Steve D'Agostino show. What the hell do you think you're doing in front of everybody? And I remember like after the game being like, dude, like screw this, man. Like, and again, my dad's a high school coach. So like, you know, he kind of talked me down and we figured it out. And I had a conversation with the coach and like that conversation like made me better because I was never going to let that happen again. Right.
Yep.
But like most, what would happen? Seriously, leading scorer on a team in your area. And that happens in the middle of a game. What's the next 24 hours look like? Because I think it doesn't matter if you're in Minnesota or New York, it's the same thing.
Uh-huh.
You know, parents meet with the coach and they're already looking at transfer in and this, and he's a leading scorer. You know what I'm saying? And it's like, how many teachable moments do we take away from kids where like, if you just let them have it, let them have that adversity, let them have that doubt, they're going to be better off for it. You just got to get through like the week. You got to get through the 2 weeks of like the, you know, awkwardness, you know?
Oh, 100%. And one of the things that I go back and forth on with, from a training aspect, is you have skilled players. And I'm going to be really vague with this because I don't think it's necessarily black and white. But you have skilled players and you have tough players. And you and I both know that you can be skilled and tough. Watching game film on you, you're obviously very tough, but you're also very skilled. I think we just put way too much emphasis on the fact that my kid goes to the gym and works on his game all the time. He's all this, but then he gets in a game and he can't have anyone hold him accountable. And I think as a society, we undervalue or we hate accountability. We run from it.
Yeah.
Like you needed that coach to be like, Dags, we're not doing this crap. And that was the best thing for you. Yet we run from that.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. How about this statement? Your hard work in the gym has nothing to do. Let me change that. Let me think. And basically what I'm trying to say is, and I get this all the time from parents, is, you know, hey, but my kid, you know, he trains 5 days a week and he's in the, you know, and he gets up 200 shots and, you know, he makes 160 of them. He can shoot and this, and he's working out with this guy and he's playing with that guy. And I try to explain this to parents, and other kids don't, you know, they're never in the gym. How come they're playing? Dude, the only thing that matters is game production.
Absolutely.
That's the statement.
Yes.
The only thing. And for a trainer, like, yeah, of course we want you to work hard. But if you're working your ass off and you're averaging 2 points a game and you're getting blown by on defense and you don't impact the game, and the other kid is a football player and he never practices freaking basketball, he just lifts all the time, but he comes in, he's getting 12 rebounds and he's setting great screens. That's what matters. The only thing that matters is game production.
Absolutely, man.
Which is like a crazy thing to say for a trainer, but I think it's true.
I mean, I have conversations with trainers like this all the time. I think that's where we get in trouble when we get a trainer that just wants to sit here and argue. This is what I do. This is what the game's about, yada, yada. But in reality, there are certain skill things that you and I can go over a million times. But if the kid doesn't have a motor or any work ethic or mental toughness to handle a little bit of adversity, they're going to struggle.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know what's interesting about that, too? So like what I've done is when I first started off, it was like so much skill stuff. You know, you're doing ball handling all the time and, you know, you're doing the two ball drills and you're doing the layups. You're holding another ball. You're doing all that stuff. And it's all good stuff. Like it helped me when I played. It helped the players. And I'm sitting there and I'd go and watch these kids play. And I'm like, God, they're like not competitive. Like they don't know how to fight through adversity. Like they don't make good decisions. So basically, like our stuff has changed to find the balance between the skill stuff, the decision making, and all the intangibles. So like, for instance, we have a kid now who's he's a freshman at Siena College. He's like 6 foot, skinny. He didn't even really have any Division II offers. Maybe he had one last year, and Siena came in late and they were like, you know, we want you to walk on. We think you're going to be really good. You know, we'll do one of those like you walk on this year, you know, scholarship the next 3 years. And, you know, I had a conversation with them, like, you know, they don't have to actually give you the scholarship the next year, right? It's not like a 4-year deal. But, you know, he's like, I trust them. We're good. He went there. He started their first game this year. Their first game, he was their starting point guard. And now, you know, he's back. He's played in every game, averages like 15 minutes. It was 3 for 3 from three yesterday. They beat Fairfield or something like that. But like, he's a kid where he shoots the crap out of it. He handles the crap out of it. And I just remember getting him in the gym and we do a ton of 3-on-3 and a ton of like live decision-making stuff. And I just remember two separate days. One day where he was shooting, but he wasn't impacting the game. And like every time he would shoot, I'd be like, Jordan, you're a point guard and you don't see that pass right there. And I literally was like calling out every single pass that he missed. I was like, I thought you said you're a point guard. Like you're gonna be a point guard at the scholarship level. And so again, like sometimes I think these kids like respond better to, you know, not so much coaching, but like almost like talking crap to them.
Yeah.
Right. They can understand that. And like the other one was sometimes what I like to do with our shooting drills is you probably have like 5 or 6 year go to shooting drills. Right.
Uh-huh.
And so I have those two, but what I'll do is they'll go through it and they'll think they have beaten it. And like, as they're making their last shot, I'm like, last part, you got to go 10 out of 10 half court to the top of the key. Go, or you got to make like 10 in a row. So like now they go, their mental state goes from like, I just beat the drill to like, oh crap, now there's another part. And it's almost like impossible, right? That like they've been running around for 3 minutes. They got to start running again and make 10 in a row, you know? And so like, he was so pissed and you're sitting there and you're like, dude, what are you going to pout about it? That you can't beat the drill, or are you going to keep going and try and beat the drill? And dude, he responded. And like, those are like the little moments within a workout, not only like how he handled the previous situation, but like that situation too, where like, yo, that kid gets it. Like, I know he's undersized. I know he's probably got like a Division II body and like, but yo, he's gonna be able to perform better than the guy who might have 2 inches and 20 pounds on him because his mental state is way stronger. So like, I've been throwing a lot more of that stuff into our training because I think this generation needs it more.
I'm with you on that. You know, one of the things that pops into my head, and I use the example of Isaiah Thomas, present day Isaiah Thomas, and I use it a lot because he get to the NBA, people are like, he's undersized. I was like, yo, this dude was undersized when he played at Washington and he scored. And guess what?
Right.
He was undersized in high school too. He just found a way. He's what I like to call a solution seeker.
Production.
Yeah, he's just able to produce. So when you talk about your training, and I love your training, I find myself pulling so much stuff from, you know, the stuff that you post, you know, just the way that you structure things. And what I do think is funny about social media is that if you post a video, you get all these idiots that think, oh, you did that for an hour. No, I didn't for an hour.
Yeah.
But to talk training in 2020, you know, we have access to film in about 42 different angles and in slow motion. And I love that. And, you know, I obviously try to use that to my advantage. But when you have a kid that has absolutely zero motor in a game, you know, I use this analogy kind of that of a mechanic. So if you're a mechanic that works for a NASCAR team, you know, you can obviously mm-hmm. go into a Toyota dealership and change the oil, no problem. But
right.
if you take a mechanic whose job is to try to figure out how to make a car go from 201.4 miles an hour to 201.8, why would you have them in the shop changing oil and not utilize the skills that they have? And so that's the question that I ask myself. Because if I really believe that I'm a specialist, you know, part of me fights and says, I want to teach you skills, but then I need you to go home and work on them.
Yeah.
But if you're not going to go home and work on them, then maybe my job as the specialist is to do exactly what we were talking about, to get on them, to challenge them and force them to make decisions.
100%. Listen, there's so much with this training stuff that I go back and forth, and you and I have the same sort of setup where we're training all ages and all skill levels. So it's not like we're just training NBA guys, where like to me, when you have one level of skill and one like age group, you can really hone in on certain things that they need to work on, right? So like, and you know, a 7-year-old is different than a 15-year-old. So like you have to find ways, okay, how do I most impact this person, not only on the court, but off the court as well? So I go back and forth with like, you know, okay, how much decision making do you throw into a workout compared to skill stuff? You know, we have guys that are suburban guys that can do all the different cone drills and two ball dribbles, but they can't actually drive with a defender on their hip. So do we not do as many reps, but we're just throwing a defender on their hip for every single ball handling and finishing rep? You know, I go back and forth on all that. So I think the hardest part and the what makes trainers really good is actually identifying what players need to work on. It's not the actual workout. Like that's secondary. So like if you can't even identify what's going to make a certain player better, then I don't think it really even matters. You're just generally going to work somebody out. And you can make them be a better basketball player, but it doesn't mean that they're going to maximize what they actually could be good at. So.
But that's where it goes back to, you know, getting a player that understands how to play. And I want to come back to what you just said. And bear with me because this is a terrible analogy. But when I first moved to Long Island, I would go to the park and play all the time. Now, I wasn't in shape.
Yeah.
I was a college basketball coach. I definitely wasn't there. But it would be like me, three other stocky guys, and some random dude.
Yeah.
And we'd run the court. And it'd be a bunch of guys that played Division I, Division II. And it was just like, we're smarter than you.
Yeah, and exactly.
We understood how to play. So when I look at, you know, my own personal skill development journey, because I was almost always the least athletic guy on the floor. So if I was going to beat you, I had to be meticulous. And I do think that there are kids, you know, you talk about the suburban kid that can do all the cone drills in the world, but they get in a game, they can't drive with any contact on their hip. So now you're forced to answer the question of how are we going to approach this? And I don't know, because you're absolutely right. I think it goes all over the place. For me personally, when I talk about the training stuff, there are times where I have 7th graders and then I have 15-year-olds. And then some weeks I take the same workouts and just flip-flop. Because, hey, we just did this 3-on-2 drill and then we did some advanced footwork stuff and both groups can utilize it. And it works. So I do think there are a lot of ways to go about things.
So I've been big into I've been really big into foundation lately. So here's like where my thought process is going is let's do it on the macro scale. Let's do it on like a team scale. So if you talk about like European development, right? All these players build their individual skill base. So they're doing literally finishing reps at 10 years old. They're doing floaters, reverses, Euro steps. They're building that foundation. They're not doing anything crazy where they're taking 20 dribbles like into a shot, right? They're building their foundation with finishing, their foundation with ball handling, their foundation with footwork. All the meanwhile, they're building their team foundation. So they're really learning how to run ball screen, right? They're learning the options, the reads, the angles, same thing with off the ball screen, same thing with like read and react, right? I truly believe this, that like if, so this is where my mind goes. If you can build that foundation, Now, all of a sudden, especially in 2020, where like as a player, I could just go on YouTube and type in like James Harden step back and I can be taught the James Harden step back. The problem is if I don't have the foundation, then that just becomes a tough shot. If I have the foundation, right, then that I can add on to that foundation with all the complex stuff. So where my mind goes is like, wait a second, how do I get all these players' foundations really, really good? Like, and again, the precision and the focus is based on their age and their skill level. But if we have a big time college guy, like for instance, I had two kids from like 2.5 hours away from where I am. They're out in Syracuse. And one kid is got a D1 scholarship. He's going next year to play in the America East for UAlbany. Another kid, I actually work with him. He gets invited to the USA Basketball Junior National Team. He's got offers from like Ohio State, Syracuse, all this stuff. We spent, now this is an in-season workout, so we're not doing any contact. We spent literally 1 hour and 15 minutes, and the two themes were precision and accountability. So like everything that we did with our footwork and our eyes and our hands and everything was we're going to try to be as precise as possible. And then the accountability was we were going to put something on every single shot. So like when we did our finishing moves, we were going to go first one to four wins, right? When we did our shooting, it was either beat the clock or it was head-to-head shooting off of different actions and situations. And we didn't do anything crazy. All I challenged them to do was to be precise and to be accountable for every single shot that they put up. And it was probably one of my best workouts of the year because it challenged them so much. It's not like we were doing crazy stuff, but it challenged them to like, yo, you have a game-winning shot head-to-head. It's 4-4. You need to make this to win. Are you going to go and like fade away and fall down to the ground for the game winner? Or are you going to like really force yourself to stay in that shot? You know, and they did a really good job, but you can tell that they've never been challenged like that in workouts. It's always just been workouts. So like, if you can get those type of guys and anybody to be, you know, precise and we're building that foundation, dude, go throw whatever finishing move you want. Go. I say this all the time too, like with our ball handling. I literally, if you look at it like this, I need to, as a ball handler, be able to get 2 feet in the paint. If I can get 2 feet in the paint, then I'm going to be able to make plays for myself and others. So like, if you back that up a little bit and I tell guys like, dude, I don't give a shit what dribble move you use to get in the paint. What do I care? I don't care. But if you have all the dribble moves, but you can't get in the paint, that's a problem. But if you can get in the paint, I don't care how you get there.
Totally. For me, I have the same philosophy when it comes to scripting things. You get a lot of guys that look really good in skill workouts because they get robotic. Now they're looking at you like, Dags, do you want me to get to a floater or a layup? And right. You want to respond with yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it doesn't matter. I just need you to make sure you see the game. Like, a lot of people call that intrinsic motivation, but I just refer to that as discovery. Like, right. You need to go through things in a workout and discover not only what works, but what doesn't work.
Yeah.
And the reason I use that, and I use it a lot on this podcast, a statement from my dad that says, a spoken truth is temporary, while a discovered truth is going to be permanent.
Yes.
And I can tell you all the time, do this, do this, do this. And you might not ever get it, but then one day you're going to come to me and say, hey, man, I get it. This makes sense. And that's because you discovered it. So now it's going to stick. And I hate using the word manipulate because I think it's so negative. But in a sense, it's almost as if we need to help manipulate some of those discovery moments so that they can discover.
Yeah. Yep. 100%. I think a lot of times you do that by two ways, is by shutting up. Right. Most coaches and trainers talk too much. And the other one would be, you know, as you can see them trying to figure it out, is if they need guidance, is to ask questions. Right. So like, the more you can like be silent, let them figure it out. And then when they need the guidance, ask questions. So they're figuring out on their own. I think those are two really good ways to get that done.
Yeah. You know? No, I agree with you. I work with a lot of youth programs in the fall and I'll be leading the workout. And I'll have coaches running up to me going, hey, they're screwing up. It's like, yeah, I know they're screwing up. They all suck right now. We just introduced this. And we have to let them go for a little bit because, first of all, I want to see who's going to actually try to fight through this. And second of all, in the game, they're not going to be able to get everything corrected in real time. They have to be able to play.
Yeah. Yep. It's super. That's a super interesting concept too, because, you know, we want these kids to get as good as possible, as fast as possible. And that's not how it works. Learning is a slow process, you know, especially I think it's tough for parents.
Well, I think it's tough for parents. I think it's tough for coaches. Specifically, yeah. The things that I struggle with, and I'm sure it's the same for you. You know, we've gone through certain footwork patterns or whatnot. But when I introduce something to a kid for the first time, I almost always know what their first mistake is going to be.
Right.
And so for me, you know, whether it's timing or whatever it is, I have to convince myself, you know, read, just shut up.
Right.
Introduce it, let them struggle, and let them go. Yeah. And then correct them.
Right. It's, you know, what's funny about that is like, okay, so naturally in the basketball training world, you are constantly trying to show everybody how much you know. And it's like, now you're getting in the workouts in front of the parents. And that's something that I learned, and I've been doing this for whatever, 11 years or 12 years. And I've gotten better at it. Like, and it also helps when you've had players that have had success, you know, where like you were saying, the situation where you're not correcting someone's like, why aren't you correcting them? Like, relax. Like, this is how learning happens. You know, it's just like you constantly want to show like, no, I am a good trainer. Like, here's what I know. I know how to teach this. Right. When sometimes it's like, you're not a trainer. You're a coach, man. You're a coach and you're a teacher. You're trying to teach these kids. It's not about you. It's not about how much you think you know. Right. It's about teaching the kids. What's the best way that they're going to learn? Right. And that's what I think for me, like I've started to get better at, and I'm constantly like every day you're trying to get better at like becoming almost like how do you become a really good teacher, a master teacher, you know?
Yeah. You know, you posted something, I think it was in the beginning of January, and it said something like, in the year 2020, I'm stuck in the middle of determining whether I should film everything or film literally nothing.
Right.
And the hardest part in literally all of this for me is that I authentically want to help players get better.
Yeah.
You know, training is my what, but my why is so different.
Right.
But at the same time, you know, this is my livelihood. I think I'm really good at what I do. And I think that that confidence is rooted in hard work and my ability and willingness to continue to learn.
Right.
So from a workout standpoint, you know, let's talk just specifically social media. I get a lot of contacts with coaches that I work with or connect with through social media. Mm. And I've actually had quite a few coaches, actually a couple coaches in the last couple of weeks, make comments about how they aren't sure if they should work with me because they think my stuff is too advanced.
Right.
And that's not the case. I just can't show a third grade girl shooting a right-handed layup on Twitter and get engagement.
Exactly.
If they do that, they say that I suck.
Right.
But if I don't do that and I go too far the other way, then they say that, oh, his stuff is way too complex and not applicable at our level, which I think is funny. And I was talking to Joe Gill last week on the podcast, who does analytics.
Yeah.
And Joe made a comment that trainers have the toughest job in the industry because you're trying to appease so many people. I even compared it to a presidential tax plan where it doesn't matter who you tax, somebody's going to be pissed off.
Right. Right.
And it's the same with basketball. I don't think it matters what type of workout you do. Someone's going to be pissed off, but you know, this is my job, so I got to figure it out.
Right. Right. It's, I always laugh, and you know, like we've talked a bunch of times about the whole social media stuff. We both think it's like, you know, we find a lot of hilarious stuff in there, but it's so funny now to see, okay, at first it was like the revolution of like all these innovative drills. And it was a lot of young trainers doing it. And now it's almost like, there's another side of the coin where it's like those basketball purists that are like, you know, you shouldn't be using props. And like, even, you know, it's like everything should be decision-making. Like if your drill doesn't involve decision-making or some game-like situation, then it's not good. And like, for me, I'm sitting there and I'm like, are they living a different life than I am? Like, are we, is the key to life not like balance,
exactly,
right?
Like,
wait a second. It's not like there's, and again, maybe it's because you and I have both trained all ages and all skill levels, that you sit there and like, yo, there are kids that need the simple reps, like ball handling reps with cones in front of them, or finishing of just like, they need to go through 100 different finishes with no defender or no decision because they need the footwork and the skill work. And then there's others that are like, dude, you need to do all decision making. I get it. But there is always that balance, you know, when you're talking about on the macro scale with a bunch of, you know, there's, it's not one way or the other. It's whatever's going to make that player better. And most of the time, you know, there's, it's somewhere in the middle.
Yes. I mean, I believe there's a ton of gray in the world. And I think we try to make things as black and white as we can.
Right.
Even from a statistics standpoint, you know, I was talking to a math guy a couple weeks ago and he's like, you know, Reed, even with stats, we can make them say just about whatever we want the stats to say.
Right.
And that's going to have a drastic impact on our training. Like I chuckle with the stats, like the Timberwolves have a 100% chance of winning when they are up by five with 0.2 seconds on the clock or less.
Right.
Like, what a great stat. Yeah. You're an idiot.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
And so to talk about things as if they're only black and white, to me, is just,
You know what's funny about that is I was actually listening to, I think I was listening to Colin Cowherd the other day, and he had Steven Jackson on, and I didn't know it was Steven Jackson because I caught it in the middle of the interview, but he was talking about something with the Spurs, and or maybe he was talking about Zion. I can't remember exactly what he was talking about, but his statement was, I don't believe in analytics. And I go, I'm like sitting there in my head, and I'm like, analytics, it's information.
Yeah.
It's information.
Yeah.
Right. So like at the end of the day, you just said it, you can make numbers say a whole bunch of different things, but imagine 2020, just having a normal conversation, be like, yeah, Reed, I don't believe in information. I don't believe, I want less information. Like, wait, what?
What?
Like, dude, that might have been the dumbest comment I have ever heard. Like, time out. You want less information, but you're going to speak on something like what that didn't, it was, but that's, you know, that's, again, that's kind of like where we're at, where it's like, you got to pick a side. You're either for analytics or against. Like, no, I'm for information. And then I will determine situation by situation, whether it's useful or it's not. Right. So I thought that was hilarious.
Yeah. Well, in the podcast before this with Joe Gill, the analytics guy, he was talking about the eye test versus analytics, and the eye test was the roadmap and analytics was the compass, but you need both. If you're stranded in the desert and you need to get to the gas station, you need the roadmap to say, hey, here's the gas station, but you also need the compass to tell you which way is west. If you just have a compass without a roadmap, you're like, hey, this is north, but I don't know where the gas station is. So his point was, you need both the eye test as well as the statistical numbers. And I do find it funny, you know, he uses the word bias a lot. And one of the examples that he gave was Kawhi Leonard in the finals last year, and how, the mid-range game is back and stuff. And did you see Fred VanVleet?
Oh, my God.
Right? Fred VanVleet shooting threes. He's 10 times more efficient than Kawhi, but we have this bias to the mid-range game. Everybody jumps on the bandwagon and they just want to run with it. And now we're sitting here with that argument.
I hate that's one of my biggest things on Instagram or on Twitter too. When people are like, mid-range isn't dead. I'm like, are we not, like, can we not look at a game and say like, yo, this is a good shot and this is not a good shot. Right. Instead of like grouping it all in one. And it's interesting, 'cause like, so all that stuff for me trickles down into development of our players. So I'll go and I'll watch some of our, you know, high school, college, and obviously I watch Kevin Huerter play during the season when he's with the Hawks and all that. But I was at a game, a high school game. We got a kid who's like 6'5". He's like a 3'4". Really, he's a wing in college, but is big enough where he could end up posting guys up depending on what level he gets to. So I go and I watch him play, and his team gets beat. They're one of the better teams in our area too. They got beat that night. They didn't play that great. You know, he spent a lot of time on the perimeter and he had like a smaller guy guarding him. And so the next day he texted me and said, hey, what did you think? And I was like, well, I go, to be honest with you, I go, and I have this conversation with a lot of players, is when I leave the game, I shouldn't have to go look at the box score for me to give my opinion. I should leave the game and say, yo, Reed dominated and impacted that game last night. Right. So like, what was your actual impact of the game? Forget about how many points you scored. Right. How many like rebounds, assists, all that. How many, you know, like times you like crossed the guy and got downhill. Like, did you impact the game? So like my thing to him was, How many offensive rebound putbacks did you get? How many times did you literally just look at your defender? And I wish I was 6'5" and say, okay, this guy's 3 inches shorter than me. I'm in the post every time he's guarding me. Every time. Until they switch, and then I'll take their big on the perimeter. It should be like that simple. And so, again, going back to like the analytics of like the eye test and then the numbers, like especially with high school players, I should be able to walk out of the gym and say, yo, that kid dominated and impacted the game the most. I don't know how many points he scored. I don't know what his stat line was, but I'm leaving because my eyeballs told me that he was the best player on the court, you know, especially in nowadays too, where like, you know, you'll go on Twitter and you'll see like, oh, this guy had 50 points. And I remember like when LaMelo Ball had 90 or like 100 and like you're watching it and you're like, bro, like I would have left. I would have left in the first quarter. Like, what the hell is that? You know, you can manipulate things now, especially if you're super talented. And it's funny, I'm going to go on a million tangents. Like, oh, interesting. LaMelo Ball got away from his dad and got into a professional setting and is like a beast. He's awesome. Dude, he's awesome. He plays the game the right way. He passes the crap out of the ball. I don't know. I just, again, I see a lot of things. There's like a lot of manipulation in not only like youth sports, but like in high school sports too, where, you know, listen, I've never seen more of it than in the last couple of years, where like a team around here will be up by 35 points in the fourth quarter and their star will still be in, like racking up points. Like, what the hell is that? Like, so you can say you have 40, so you can post it and get more hits and likes and more notoriety. Like, listen, eyeballs are going to tell you, like a coach is going to come to the game and look at you and be like, yo, you can play or you can't play, you know? So I don't know. That's one of my biggest pet peeves, I guess.
Well, I went to a Division III basketball game or watched a Division III game this Saturday, and there's a guard on the team that I know, and he had like 14 points, 13 rebounds, and a handful of assists, and you watch the game and you get done, and I'm looking at the box score and I'm like, this dude sucked. I'm watching this, and all I'm thinking is, you're missing open shooters, you're inefficient, you dribble too much. But if somebody just looks at the box score, they go, huh, had a pretty good game. Yeah. Right? It's not they missed the 5 of 17 or whatever he was from the floor, and you think he has a really good game.
Right. Listen, 100%. 100%. And you know what's funny about that is I always say my college coach used to always say, you know, players are going to do what you emphasize, right? So, like, I remember, you know, a game where we got killed on the glass. We'd spend the whole week emphasizing, like, rebounding drills. We'd come out the next game, and we'd all of a sudden have, like, 12 offensive rebounds, and we'd dominate, right? You're going to do, for the most part, like, good teams are going to do what their coaches emphasize. Youth and high school players and parents are going to do what college coaches reward. So, like, I love, and this is one of my, I stand on my pedestal with this, I think college coaches are just as much to blame for everything that's going on in youth and high school basketball as the trainers, as the parents, as the AAU guys. They never throw themselves in, but they should be thrown into it, right? Because they tweet that they want the guy who's going to clean up their water bottle on the bench. They want the guy who's going to cheer for his teammate. And then they reward the guy with the scholarship who can be a jerk 3 out of 7 days of the week, but plays above the rim. It just, they're going to do what they reward. So, like, again, parents, all this stuff that we talk about, like, they, you know, kid manipulating and going and getting, you know, 30 points on 30 shots on his high school team and all everything you just talked about with this other kid. Yeah, because a college coach is going to come see a kid that's averaging 35 points a game, not a kid that's averaging like 14 for a middle of the pack, you know, team in New York State. It is what it is. So what do players emphasize? They emphasize points, you know? And that's like the discussion that we have a lot with players and parents is, okay, like you going out and, cause in high school, they're not keeping like how many shots you take for the most part. And that's not getting to a college coach. They're not seeing that. All they're really seeing are like points, who's the leading scorers, right, in the area, and they're getting like feedback and things like that. But, you know, so yeah, I get it. You can manipulate the game. That's going to get people there, but then they're going to use their eyeballs and see like, yo, you're not doing it. You're not playing the game the right way. You're not playing to win. You're not playing for your teammates. So it's, at the end of the day, you're not even achieving what you actually want to achieve, where if you just did things the right way, you'd have a better chance of succeeding. And maybe it's not, you know, like I say this to our kids all the time, like if you do the right things, good things will happen. It may not be exactly what you want to happen, but it will be something good for you because you're doing things the right way. And so like, okay, instead of you trying to manipulate and being a bad teammate and shooting the ball 20 something times, maybe you shoot it less. And instead of, you know, the low division ones who lose 20 games a year coming after you and being like, man, we really like that kid. All of a sudden, it's a high division two that's going to win a ton of games, right? Or like a high division three that's going to win a ton of games because you play the right freaking way. You know, I have those conversations all the time with players and parents.
Well, I remember going to the Final Four, and I think it was 2014 in Atlanta.
Yeah.
And it was that year that they played the D3 game instead of playing it in Virginia. They played it in Atlanta. And I watched a kid by the name of Duncan Robinson.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he played for Division III. Was it Williams?
Williams, yeah.
Williams. Yep. Yep. And now the dude's shooting the absolute piss out of the ball for the Miami Heat.
Right, right. Yeah.
Now, obviously, you know, he ends up at Michigan and has some things happen as a different type of talented athlete. But you see some of these kids with just unrealistic expectations. And I think it has to do a lot with social media. And I'm glad you pointed out the coaches. Having coached before Twitter was massive like it is now.
Yeah.
But there are so many coaches that tweet stuff that I'm like, would you just shut up?
Shut up, dude, right?
Like, you're my buddy. I know you, but knock it off. And I think, honestly, it's coach speak. Like, these guys will get a coaching job, and then they change the way they talk like they're not your friend.
Right.
Like, don't talk to me coach speak. Just shut up if you're going to do that.
Dude, 100%. I love that.
But you get some of this. I love that. The kids, they see this. And it's like, how do I word this? You know, my 240 characters, how can I be the most efficient? And then my stats, you know, how do I fit them in there? You know, I get parents that are sending me stuff. They're like, hey, my kid's in seventh grade.
Yeah.
And I'm like, listen, you got plenty of time. You're not from here. Call me in 4 years and I'll help you then. And then they're like, oh, by the way, here's this, this, and this. And I think that leads into a lot of these misconceptions of either playing overseas or getting a scholarship, which is one of my favorite topics of all time. Because if I had a dollar for every kid that told me they were getting recruited to a place that they weren't, or a kid that told me they're heading overseas, you know, I want to smack these dudes. And I have parents that hit me up all the time and tell me how the recruiting process works. I'm not claiming to know it all, but you've never been around the game. You played hockey, and I was on the D3, D2, NAI level.
Yeah.
You get a kid that says, hey, I got a partial scholarship to Creighton. That's Division I. It's a head count. There's no partial scholarships. Yeah, it's not possible. Yeah, so I do want to ask you, you know, we're really sensitive in the year 2020, but how do you handle this when some parents or kids need some tough love or some honest truth?
Right. Well, can we go back to the college thing for a second with the college coaches? Because I think it brings up like a good point, and it's something that we touched on earlier in the podcast. Was like, I wish so like that. The letters that I got from American University and Binghamton University are the two that stick into my mind the most because they were so direct, and they were basically like, "Yo, we don't think you're good enough." So like, what'll happen with a lot of our players is, you know, I like things to happen organically. So I don't want to, like, we have a kid. So the kid that I was talking about, that is at Siena, Jordan King, he was getting recruited. I was begging my school, St. Rose. There's another school, like two or three other schools in the Northeast 10 conference. Like, can you guys take a look at him? But they were all schools that had already reached out to him. Right. Cause I want it to be organic. I don't want to force a player on somebody because I think that the more the coaching staff is invested in a player, the better chance of success they're going to have. So like, if you find him, you know, you're a college coach and you find that person yourself, like you're going to have more, like I found him, like I have a more of a vested interest. So I don't like to push people. And the last thing you want is somebody in a situation that, you know, nobody even cares if they're really even there. And that does actually happen. But I wish when I was talking to these schools, and I see it all the time, and you get the feedback from the parents, like, yeah, I went and I spoke with the coach from whatever, and they said, you know, they like me, but they wish I was like 2 inches taller. And they say stuff that like the kid could never possibly even freaking work on. And so it's like, man, I wish, you know, what could have been. Like, I have, and I might've said this before on a different podcast, but we had a kid who went to the Yale camp, and one of their coaches, the dad calls me after and was like, one of the coaches said he loved my son. And, you know, they said, that they're just pissed because all their two guards are like 6'7". And I was like, and the kid was like 6'3". And I'm like, Mike, I go, dude, do me a favor. I'll give you $100 if you go on Yale's roster right now and you find me there a 1-2 guard that's 6'7". And so he like called good me luck. Back like 10 minutes later. He's like, what the hell? Like, they don't have any. I'm like, I know. And so like, so not to call out Yale. Yale's great. We got a player at Yale. He had a game winner the other night. Like, Yale's freaking awesome. And I'm just using that as an example. And I don't even know if it was, you know, how they have different coaches at these academic or at these higher. So it might've been somewhere, but like, I wish that when that occurs, the coach would just say, you know, Reed, I don't think you're good enough for our level. I think you're a good player and you're a college player and you're going to find a spot. I just, we don't think you're good enough to play here. Dude, how far would that go in determining that kid's future? That kid has a choice. To either be a baby and pout and be like, oh, they don't like me, or to be like, screw that. I'm going to prove them wrong. And I'm going to land somewhere where I'm going to play and I'm going to show them how good of a player I am. Dude, that is, to me, that is the answer. That's the answer.
That goes back to the gift of doubt.
Yeah. Yep.
Right. So, like, at the college level, you know, I don't want to name names. You know, I've worked at one of the best. Yeah. D3 leagues in the country, one of the best D2 leagues in the country. And last year, you know, but a year and a half ago, the D2 league, they were not handing out any scholarships in the summer. Now, obviously, live periods are different, but the guys would go to Vegas like that last weekend. And after the weekend's done, scholarships are flying off the table because they're trying to hide kids in hopes of getting them to commit before the regular season starts so these other guys can't go watch them.
Yeah.
They're trying to hide guys. You get how it works. Like, Kentucky's not going to go offer a guy a scholarship until he's got 10 scholarship offers from smaller programs. You know, in the Northern Sun, you have schools like Northern State that's played in the national championship game, or in the past couple of years, you have Duluth, some of those guys. They're not going to offer somebody typically until one of the bottom tier Northern Sun teams offer somebody. So you end up sitting here with a kid that's like a, you know, a borderline Division I kid, and no one's offered him.
Right.
No, I think it's crazy. I remember bringing a kid to my boss. I'm like, I got a connection. I think we can get this kid signed. And he asked me, he's like, well, who else has offered him? And I'm like, well, one of you idiots is going to be, have to be the first one to pull the trigger.
Yeah, exactly.
Because you got all these coaches that are so concerned about not being wrong. So if I offer him and then you offer him at another school and then DJ Sackman offers him at another spot and then he sucks, then we could say, oh, well, we all offered him. So, you know, it wasn't just me.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think I say this all the time when I'm talking to some of our other trainers or some of my buddies that are college coaches. I feel like there's coaches, and especially at the smaller schools, right? So like Division I, you're going to have a huge pool. There's going to be people above you, below you, but like Division II, Division III, it's very subjective into what could be a good player. Like when I was coming out, like nobody would have ever thought that I was going to be a two-time, you know, All-American at Division II, right? It was subjective. You get in the right situation, they develop you, you know, you have the skill, you're productive, like you have the IQ, like you can make that work, you know? So like, it's just interesting to me. Like, I think that college coaches can like rack their brains too much about the recruiting process. It's like you look at a kid, especially, you know, this low Division I, Division II, Division III, like you have to develop players. You're not getting, if you're getting a stud, he should be, and everybody knows he's a stud, then he's got some sort of academic or attitude issue, right? So that, you know, you're gonna have to deal with. So like, okay, I like this kid. I don't need to know who else offered him, right? I've seen him play enough. I really like him, right? And so why do I have to go look like, okay, I'm going to go see another kid play. If I think that this kid is good enough for me and I really like him and I think he's going to do well, I go see another kid. I'm like, well, maybe he's better. Well, who the hell knows who's better? How can you determine without getting them in the same situation and letting them either play head-to-head multiple times or putting him in your exact situation, who's going to be better? How could you tell? Mm-hmm. How could you tell? You know, like again, I'm sure if you looked at me and you looked at the kid that Binghamton took, you would have said that the kid from Binghamton is better, right? Until we got in our own situations and played head to head, then we found out who was better.
Yep.
You know, exactly. I think they a lot of coaches overthink the whole process, and they're trying to compare kids that, like, yo, it is very possible that me and another kid could be very similar. And if we go to two separate schools, and maybe if we went to different schools, we would be even better than we were. So, like, a lot of it falls in a situation that you're actually in at your school. How much does the coach believe in you? What system do they run? Do they like small point guards? Do they not like small point? You know, how do they play fast? Do they play slow? There's so many things that go into it that it's hard to compare kids. And I think that's part of the reason too why, you know, all these kids are transferring, is that it's super hard to evaluate players. It's really hard, you know, and I don't know if, again, so how do you relay that information to parents? Like, okay, here's what a college coach is saying. Do you come out and say, like, well, listen, you know, this school has had 50% of their players transfer in the last 2 years. So I wouldn't trust anything that they say, because they're wrong 50% of the time, or don't know how to handle 50% of their players. You know, that's a conversation where that's an angle where that conversation could go as well.
Yeah. And we've talked about this, you know, in the past hour, of youth basketball to high school basketball. You touch on AAU stuff at this point, and all this, you got these guys that, and it's not all of them, but high and mighty, like, oh, we got all these problems with basketball.
Yeah.
Come on, we got to fix them. When at the same time, some of the stuff that I've heard that coaches tell recruits, I'm like, they did what?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, it's wild. It's wild. And again, it's all, I think there's like a game within the game, right? Like, every coach is like, hey, it's a family, and, you know, we want you to be part of the family and this and that. And really, it's more so about, like, you know, can you get the player? Like, I want to get the player so that, you know, the other school in our conference doesn't get them. Right. It's like, that's the game within the game. So they're going to say whatever they can say to get that kid. Right. And then if it doesn't work out, the kid wasn't good enough. He wasn't good enough. Right. Like, wait, what? Like, you were the one that said he was good enough to begin with. Right. So it's like, it's, I don't know. It's a crazy game. I'm 100% with you. And it's hard. So, like, again, to me, if everything was black and white, if you don't like a kid, just say you don't like a kid and you don't think he's good enough. And then everybody's on the same page. Then you don't have delusional parents who say, like, yeah, well, my kid visited this mid-major Division I, and they said, you know what, if he made 50% of his threes, he could be a Division I guy. Or, like, you know, or, hey, you know, you need to put on 20 pounds. Like, bro, just say you don't like them and you don't think they're good enough to play for you. Right? You're going to help them find something else, you know?
And what you'd end up doing is help create this culture where there's much more trust involved with the high school coaches and the college coaches, which then leads to better relationships.
Yeah.
Because I got buddies that are college coaches that are like, hey, you know what, Deggs, if I'm recruiting you and you're not interested, you don't have to have a reason.
Right.
Just tell me, hey, Reed, I appreciate it, I'm thankful, but I just don't see myself at your school, because now I can go, hey, great, thanks, I'm going to go recruit somebody else.
Right.
Like,
right. Yep.
And that whole mindset, how many times do, for as much as college coaches complain that, oh, these kids are just stringing me out, and just, I talk to kids all the time. They're like, yeah, I'm not going there. I'm like, well, you got to tell them. I had that conversation with Tyrell Terry, who's at Stanford now. And in between his junior and senior year, he's coming home at night and he's just like, oh my goodness, I got to talk to 17 coaches every single night. I'm ready to be done.
Right.
And I said that, Ty, the best thing that you can do is to start telling them, thank you so much, I'm not interested.
Yeah. Yep.
And that's okay.
100%. The more, again, I don't know. I had, you know, I'm sure we have similar conversations with all of our players, but the one kid that I work out from, Andre Jackson, he's going to UConn next year. He, like, dunks all over the place. He's always on, like, overtime and all these different places, because he's got, like, crazy in-game dunks all the time. But, like, we had a conversation and I told him, I'm like, dude, I could not imagine what it would be like to be an elite player now with all the social media. So, like, you're getting, not only are you getting coaches that contact you nonstop, you're getting fans of the schools that are always tweeting at you to hey, come to my school and this and that and blah, blah, blah. And it's just like, yo, you're trying to make, like, a really big decision in your life. and you're trying to sift through facts of like, you know, is what this coach is telling me, is that, does that match up to like what is actually happening, right? Like, hey, we play fast. Like, do you actually play fast? Like, oh, we're going to put you in ball screen. Like, wait, do you actually run ball screen? Right. So like, and there's all this outside noise and, you know, bull crap that these guys have to kind of sift through, that it's hard. And the more you can just whittle it out, like you just said, like, hey, if you don't like a school and you've done your actual due diligence on them, not like, hey, I don't like this school because it's in this state. Well, you don't know if you like that state. Maybe you've never even been there before, you know? So I agree with you on all ends. Everything could be a lot more efficient if we realize like, yo, it's what's in the best interest for the kid, right? Whatever's the best interest for the kid is like what we all strive. At least that's what I get when I talk to college coaches. That's what they're in it for, right? They're all family and all that. Then okay. How do we make this whole recruiting process more efficient on all ends? How do we get the trainers to stop telling kids that they're all that and be honest with them, right? How do we get the college coaches to really give them honest feedback so kids can make decisions, right? How do we get the kids two ways on this? Number one, to let schools that don't, you know, like if they have 12 Division I offers and they know that they're not going to go to five schools after they've done their due diligence and stuff, how do we get them to tell those five schools, right? How do we get them to stop string along? Maybe I'm a Division II guy and I'm hoping for, you know, Division II scholarship, but I got a lot of like high Division IIIs that are all over me, right? Like, how do I actually tell a kid, like, listen, you don't have any scholarships left. The highest you have are high academic Division IIIs. Like, you need to interact with them. That's what you have right now. And then if five Division II scholarships come along and you think that they're better options for you, right? Then you can tell them, hey, you know, I think I have, you know, thank you for recruiting me and blah, 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 and whatever, and move on. You know, because I think it's two ends. I think it's, you know, that other end of,
we have kids that don't even respond to coaches. And it's like, how do you get them to understand you are the level that you're getting recruited at right now? So if you only have Division III coaches contacting you, like, that's who is recruiting you. That's the level you're at. And then as you get better and you do the right things and, you know, hopefully higher offers come or what you perceive to be better situations, because we're not even getting into like the high Division IIIs that would blow the doors off the mid to low Division IIs, right? Same thing with like the high Division II. But if you know, you get a scholarship offer, you didn't have one, and okay, now you move on to that next level, and you can tell the other coach just like, hey, here's where I'm at in my recruiting. Thank you. Whatever, you know, I think that's a big problem too. I have that conversation a lot. Like, hey, I put in the work. I should be a Division II guy. Yeah, but you're not. Like, what do you mean? You know, that's interesting.
Yeah. You know, yesterday I had a conversation with a Division I head coach. He's a mid-major guy, has, you know, connected with one of the players. One of my guys plays for him. And we were talking about the team, whether they're buying in or not. And
yeah.
And he just said, you know, yeah, I love this team. We just suck. And, you know, we can't make shots. We can't make the right pass. We can't rebound. But I love this team. Absolutely love this team. Right. And so he's like, we're going to be okay. But now you run into the problem where you might have a kid that says, hey, Dags, look, I'm better than that guy. Right. I'm like, you might be better than that guy, but that guy shouldn't be playing in that league either.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So now you fight that battle.
Yep. I struggle with that. Not struggle with it, but I have these conversations of like, you and just do, again, the way that I see it, it's not just Division I, Division II, Division III. There's layers to it, right? There's like mid-major Division I's that are better than high-major Division II's that are like the bot, or sorry, there's high mid-major Division I's that are better than high-major Division I's that are at like the bottom of the Power Five conferences. You know, you look at teams like Vermont is great. They've been in the tournament however many years in a row. You know, like Iona for years was, they went four straight years. You know, these are mid-major programs that are really, really good year in and year out. And you try to explain to these kids, like, whatever your top level that you're getting recruited at, when you look at it, if those teams are perpetually losing 20 games, right? So number one, that's the top level that you're getting recruited at. So that's going to be your hardest path to find time on the court as a freshman and then after, right? And then you throw on top of that, that they're losing 20 games every single year. Like, you need to expect 2 years where you're going to be miserable, You're going to be miserable. You throw in the not playing with the losing, and that's a whole mixture. Like, that's a recipe for disaster. So when you're looking at all your options, ease of playing time, which means like, and I guess ease isn't really the right word, but you know, what are the real chances that you're going to be on the floor as a freshman, right? Or as a sophomore. And then is it a winning program? You know, and for me, I was lucky enough. My options were, I had two Division II schools, both were like winning programs. And then I had Northfield, Mount Hermon, a prep school wanted me to go there. And then a handful of Ivies were like, if you go there, we'll take you the following year. And they weren't great Ivies, but in a basketball sense. And so like, I'm so thankful that I picked that school basketball wise, because I won 20 games every year. I got on the, I started, you know, almost every game as a freshman. And so like right away, I hit the ground running and I had a great time, right? Instead of always, we're losing. I've been on one losing team my whole year, is when I, or my whole career, was when I played in Hungary. It was the first year out of college playing pro, and it was miserable, miserable. I'd never in my life gone into a game knowing that you we cannot win. We could play the best game that we're not going to win. We're not going to be, and it's like an eye opener. And like, I'm like, yo, I don't want to live my life like that. So I try to give that to our players, because it's no different at the college level, except that, you know, number one, you're not really getting paid to do it. And number two, like the coaches have way more control of like, yo, you're still up at 5 a.m., right? You're still doing all the mandatory stuff, whether you're playing 1 minute or 40 minutes, and whether you've won 20 games or one game, you know? And I think that's a portion too, that the parents and the players don't understand.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I think it's fascinating that you brought up the losses that you've taken in your career. You know, you have these kids that are, I don't think the parents understand. I don't think the kids understand. You want to go play right away. Are you ready to take a bunch of L's the first couple years of your college right. career? And I didn't even tell you this was coming. So you set the ball on a tee working yeah. with Kevin Herter.
Yeah.
And I get this question a lot. How do you train a professional athlete? You know, they're already pros. And I'm like, well, trust me, we got a lot of weaknesses here.
Yeah.
Playing for the Atlanta Hawks, I love Trey.
Yeah.
I think Collins has a ton of potential.
Yeah.
But you're talking about a guy, like a kid in Kevin Herter, about to walk into the world's best basketball league. All right, Kev, you're about to take more L's in year one and two yeah. than you ever have before.
Yeah.
And you're going to have people, no matter how well you play, tell you that right. you suck.
Right.
How do you go about that?
Yeah, I think, you know, that's, again, that's like such an eye opener for these guys. I think number one, at least, and I can only think from my perspective, like number one, I would assume that the money kind of helps, right? So like, okay, so there's a, but like from a purely like competitive aspect, I think you have to take the positives in everything, right? So like for Kev and his situation in Atlanta, number one, at least they're going in the right direction, right? They're getting like great pieces and they're going to be moving forward, right? Number two would be, and a lot of guys that he got drafted with in that draft class, they don't have the same opportunity that he has as a 20, 21, 22 year old next year to be on the court, right? And learn from your mistakes and make decisions. And, you know, he's hit a handful of clutch shots this year. And so you look at it of like, okay, here's my career. It's bigger than just this one year right now. Number one, we're moving in the right direction, which is great. Number two, I'm getting a ton of opportunity and the coaching staff is really doing a good job in trying to help me develop and let me play through my mistakes, you know, but I'm sure, listen, I've talked to him. Like I went to the Knicks game this year. They played in New York over like right before Christmas and they were down 25 points in the second quarter. It was terrible. It was terrible. So like, I remember
to the Knicks,
And I'm like, yo, like you just need to like, you know, there's going to be games where this is going to happen. And it's just like, okay, how do I keep my mind right of like, hey, next play, right? Like the next play is the biggest one, right? We may be down in the second quarter, but I'm 21. I'm still trying to show everybody that I belong in the league and I can be successful and I can be efficient. Like every play matters to you, whether you're up 20 or down 20, you know? So I think you look at the pros. Now you look at some other guys that he got drafted with, like Shamit. You know, he's on the Clippers and they're trying to win a championship. So he might not be getting as much time, right? But he's getting, he's getting a lot of like winnable and teachable moments, right? Same thing with probably like DiVincenzo for the Bucks, you know, same thing. But, you know, it's when you get to that level, it's like, okay, how do I prove that I belong here? You know, how do I individually become the best player that I can be and become a valuable asset for an organization? And then it's like, okay, now it's like, now that I proved all that, how do I best help my team win games and, you know, get to the playoffs and all that, you know? I think that's kind of like the mental side of all that.
Oh, it has to be incredibly difficult.
Yeah.
I've had conversations with Cole Aldrich when he got to come home and play for the Timberwolves.
Yeah.
And he's sitting on the bench and he's like, we suck. The guys don't like Thibodeau.
Yeah.
I think everybody knew that. It wasn't a surprise to anybody. But, you know, whether it's talking to Cole or Tyus Jones or Jake Layman, you know, who's with the Timberwolves now, who's just come back from an injury, and now you're there and you're trying to dissect how everything's working. And, you know, the Timberwolves, I think they just made the biggest, the most trades. We got Okogie and Karl-Anthony Towns. That's it from last year. And
right.
So to put that all together and just to be able to handle.
Yeah, it's a mental game. The NBA is a mental game for sure. You know, for some guys, it's everything that you're talking about. For some guys, it's like, you know, like even look at Cam Reddish. Like he was horrendous in the beginning of the year.
They have him too.
He's been awesome lately. It's like, okay, the mental side is starting. He's understanding how to play. He's understanding actions. He's understanding his spots, when to shoot it, when not to shoot it. And he's been great. You know, so I think there's, because these guys have already proven, number one, you're not in the NBA without the size, speed, athleticism, right? And then you're not, you know, you have some sort of skill that is an NBA skill. And then it's your mind is, okay, how do I put that all together, right? And do it in like a team setting. So, that stuff is always wild. So like when you bring it back to all the college and recruiting, I just think it's, you know, parents get so caught up in my kid is the best, that they want their kid to reach the highest level possible, but they don't understand that it's not like black and white, depending on like what conference you're in, right? Or like what division, you know, your Division I, Division II, Division III. And I know it's cliche to say that it's like all about fit, but it really is. And what's a good fit for one kid, you know, may not be a good fit for another kid. Like I have coaches, when I reach out to other teams in the Northeast 10, which is the league that I played for, St. Rose, their first question, I was like, well, how come St. Rose isn't on it? I'm like, whoa, wait a second. Like you guys are completely different than St. Rose, right? Like just because I played there doesn't mean that this kid is a good fit for to play there, you know? So it's so true. It's like, you got to kind of see the whole picture and not just, hey, what are other people going to say if I don't go to the highest level I can, right?
Well, I got a kid that I know, getting to know his dad pretty well, who had, you know, some mid to low to mid major Division I interest, and he's going Division II.
Yeah.
Right? They have what he wants academically. The basketball stuff makes sense.
Yeah.
And because let's be honest, like if you want to go to the highest level, there's nothing wrong with that. But if you're doing it so that you could tweet about it and then have your friends like tell and feel cool, like after you graduate 1 month, no one cares.
No one cares. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, what's funny too, is like, and it's different in the Midwest to hear, is there are so many low Division I's in the Northeast. So like there is so, and I remember I played in a Division II All-Star game. We had a kid that was a big, tall kid. I think his name was Attila Santos was his name. He was a beast. I think he played at Minnesota Mankato. And he was telling me, that, and tell me if this is true, is Minnesota the only Division I basketball program in?
Yes, correct.
Yeah, so like I remember him telling me, like, yeah, we have you're either going to Minnesota or you're going to like, and you want to stay in state, like close to your family, like you're gonna go to a Division II or Division III school. I'm like, bro, you would have had 15 Division I offers from the Northeast Conference, the America East, the MAC, like here's a good one for you. And this is, I try to give all the parents, every time a story like this pops up, I try and forward it out to our parents. Merrimack finished third in the Northeast 10 last year. They have a really good guard. It's like a triple double guy. He averages like 12 points, like 8 assists, 8 rebounds. they just moved up into the Northeast Conference this year, so they're not even eligible for the NCAA tournament or any postseason play. They're in first place in the conference with three games left, you know? And it's like, wait a second, you guys didn't even win the Northeast, or you didn't even win the Northeast 10 last year. You're going to win the Division I league that you just went to this year, you know? So, you know, little things like that, you know, again, perspective, just perspective on everything. And again, what is like the best, what is the best thing for the kid, you know? It's hard. It's hard. That's for sure.
I love that you talk perspective, you know, and as we bring this to a close, we have a couple segments that we like to get to. And the first segment is called Back to the Drawing Board. With the podcast being called The Drawing Board, you know, when I was a college coach, whenever we had to make a big adjustment or something wasn't working, you'd often hear the phrase, you know, it's time to go back to the drawing board. So you're talking perspective for these kids, for these coaches. You know, when you have to go back to the drawing board, how do you adjust when something isn't working, or what's your approach to that?
Yeah, so I think I go back to, and you kind of hit on it before, like, okay, I want to touch on like my why, like the why in your marriage, like, you know, the why and, you know, why you started the business, why you're into training, all that, and get back to like the root or the foundation that we had spoke about before. Like, why am I actually doing it? Because there's so many things that pop up that can take you in different routes, and hey, there's a money making opportunity here, and you just kind of like lose, you know, that path of like, why am I actually doing what I'm doing? The other part, and this would more so apply to like training, is the further that we get out, I'm 34, so you know, I haven't played competitively since I was 26, so it's almost been like 10 years now, is I try, and even further back to when I was like going to camps as like a youngster, is to try to put my head, like, what was I like, or what was I thinking at that age, right? So like for our camps, our youth camps, we do a ton in our area, and I used to be like so like regimented about everything. Like, here's what we're teaching them, here's what we're learning, blah, 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 here's, and like so focused. And one of our trainers one time was like, dude, do you even remember when you were in like fifth grade and you went to camp? What did you want to do? And I'm like, and I like thought about it for a second. I'm like, probably just play. Like, I wanted to play. And he's like, yeah, of course. So not that you have to, you know, just let people run free, but you got to move. You can teach them. So like for our camps, like, can I teach you one thing, right? Especially our youth camps. Can I teach you one thing, right? And that you're going to learn and pick up and be able to do on your own, right? And then we're going to have fun. Those are like the two things, right? It's not, again, it's not about me showing the kids how much knowledge I have. Like, try to get a fifth grader to learn more than one thing, you know, in a day. It's hard. So I think those are, you know, those are kind of what I go back to, again, with drawing board with, not only in the business, but then also in life as well.
I love it. I love it. I'm always interested to see how people, or hear how people approach a little adversity in their life and what their mindset is. Another one, favorite follow. We're big on social media. You know, we joke about it. We're on it. It doesn't have to be basketball related, but who's your favorite follow?
I like Rex Chapman.
Yes.
He's good, man. He's always like, there's days where I'm like scrolling through my timeline and I'm like, you know, screw this guy and screw that guy. And then like his stuff pops up. I'm like, oh, that's pretty cool. Let me get on with my day.
No, I love it. Our next segment is 2020. You know, hindsight's 2020. You know, I look back at my life, you know, the game of basketball specifically has brought me a lot of great things, blessed me in a lot of ways, but a lot of times I didn't notice those things in the moment. So can you give me an example of some, you know, somebody or something that happened in your life that impacted you that you didn't notice till down the road?
Yeah, I have a couple people. Like, I've always said my college coach would like gave me a chance when nobody else would, you know, and like it almost got to the point too where I really believe this. So like, he gave me a scholarship because he thought that I would be really good at St. Rose. And then when he gave me the scholarship, and I accepted and I was going there, you know, like a Division I coach in our area was like, told him, he was like, hey, Dags is a good player. And he's like, yeah, we're glad we got him. He's like, yeah, he's a good Division III player. And my coach was like, oh, okay, like, whatever. And so, like, I think I started my second game into my freshman year, second or third game. And I think part of it was because my coach was, like, giving a big FU to, like, because there's multiple instances like that in our area where people were, like, saying stuff like that. And he was just like, yo, like, F you. Like, I'm going to start him. He's good enough, and he's going to start 130 games for me. So, like, him just giving me that opportunity, and obviously I earned it and all that, but, like, you know that. It takes a leap of faith to have a freshman on the court for 30 minutes a game, and more so an undersized freshman, right? That's like 100 and 155 pounds playing scholarship basketball, you know? So, like, him, and then also I would say my father and my grandfather, you know, just – we talked about growing up and working. Like, if I didn't have that, you know, I mean, I achieved what I achieved through work ethic, right? And, like, being competitive and being able to bounce back. And you touched on working on the farm. Like, that's where you hone that stuff. Like, you don't hone that stuff on the basketball court. You hone that stuff in life. So just them, you know, having the presence of mind to put me through that when I was younger too just helped me out a ton.
I love looking back on some of those things to – you know, kind of give us a clear picture of why we do things. You know, we obviously know our what is being a trainer.
Yeah.
But what's our why and why do we do these things? And so when someone asks, you know, how did you get into this, to be able to look back and really know exactly what that was.
Yeah, exactly.
Who's the toughest player you've ever had to guard?
Let's see. I have to go back. Okay, so there's a guy, I don't even know his freaking name. So there was a guy my first year out in, and now I played against Syracuse. We talked about that. Like, I guarded Johnny Flynn. Like, there's this guy in Hungary who was 30, I think he was like 36 at the time when I got over there, 36 or 37. And he averaged in the league, he was averaging like 19 points a game and like 9 assists a game, like led the league an assist like by 2 or 3 assists. And we'd watch film on him, and his team was really, really good. And I'm like, dude, that guy is so freaking slow. Like, what the hell? And then I, you know, you go and you play against him and you guard him and you're like, dude, this guy gets anywhere that he wants. And like, I almost like, and it was the time, like, I was a huge Steve Nash guy. That was my guy. I'm like, yo, this guy is way more like Steve Nash than I freaking am. He can get anywhere he wants, going super slow, and then can get his shot off or make the right pass. It was the weirdest shit. Cause you know, you're growing up in America and you're like, yo, speed kills, right? Like, size kills. And all of a sudden you got this guy who's like, it's almost like Luka Doncic now.
Yeah.
Like, how slow is he? Dude, he gets wherever he wants.
Whenever
he wants, makes the right play, pass. It's just when guys have like, that's special. That's super special when you have that. So I don't know the guy's name, but he was a Hungarian dude, played for the team. His name was like Falco. He was freaking good.
Falco, that I think I might have a guy that's actually playing over there. Gonna have to do some.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm gonna have to do some Falco research.
And then like their second name is like a long ass name. It starts with an S and then like a Z, and I wouldn't even know how to like pronounce it.
Yeah. Last one. Favorite teammate. I love this one because sometimes we go all the way back to high school with guys. Sometimes we're all over the place. So. Who's a favorite teammate you ever played with?
Oh man! So let me give you a couple, but I'll write it down. Like I always say this. Let me just throw out like my high school teammates. Like I always think I played pros. Like if I could go back to one game, I'd go back to a high school game. It's just like it's the first time playing in front of like 1,000 or 1,500 people. Like everything is new. You're playing with your boys that you grew up with. You know, so like. For me, like, okay, throw all high school teammates in there in case they're listening, which they're probably not going to like. I love you guys. But my best teammate was probably a guy. He's an assistant coach at Fordham right now. His name's Mike DePauli. And so he was a year ahead of me at St. Rose. We were both similar. He was like 6 foot Italian guard, right? Like was like a shooter and all that stuff. And I kind of, like he was almost like next in line. And when I started playing a lot, his minutes went down. But then so he turned himself and he wasn't fast. He was slow. He turned himself into like, he's like, the only way I'm going to get on the court is if I'm the best defender, into like a pickup full court lockdown defender. And so by the time he was a senior and I was a junior, we started together and just like seeing his path of like, you know, not only helping me out you know, navigate through when I was, you know, younger than him. He had been there for a couple of years already. So not only helped me with that, but then just seeing like his path to being a starter, and like he completely changed his game from being a guy that averaged like 30 points a game in Westchester in high school to like, yo, I'm going to average 5 points a game and I'm going to guard the shit out of people because that's the only way I'm going to play. So I think, and he's still a good friend right now, and, you know, Fordham's struggling a little bit, but I'm hoping that, you know, he really wants to be a head coach. School would be lucky to have him because he's like locked in. You know, you could tell that he's like, you know, he was had that coach mindset even when he was a player.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. I love hearing the stories like that of, you know, I think back to, obviously I didn't play at a high level, but looking back on some of those moments when there were a ton of people there in the stands watching you, like you watch some of these, I'm watching the Big Ten games. It's like Penn State versus, who are they playing? Indiana. I got a kid who plays at Indiana, Race Thompson, and there's a big steal at the end of the game, and it's like, holy smokes, that's loud in there. Assembly Hall's going nuts. Even yesterday, I'm watching my guys at Wisconsin yesterday get a win, and you're just like, wow, this is crazy. You go overseas, they're chanting going and like crazy. Going crazy and throwing stuff at you, and yet you're like, I remember when I was in high school.
You know what's funny, too, is I have a buddy who I play with in college. He works for ESPN Radio in Denver. He's like he's one of their co-hosts of one of their shows with Brandon Stokely, who used to be a Denver Bronco. But he used to always say, he's like very dramatic. So like he used to, but he said some really good stuff. And the one time, and he gets you thinking about things differently. And he was like, I remember in college, you know, I think maybe we had just played at the Carrier Dome. And he was like, yo, think about this. How many people in their lives have had 1,000 or more people cheering for them at the same time?
Yes.
Right. And it was like just a whole different, like you take it for granted when you're playing in high school and you're playing in, you know, bigger gyms, and then if you get a chance to play in college and then pro, like you take that for granted and you're looking like all the people that, like, you know, that's a crazy feeling, you know, and even more so if they hate you and they're going crazy and yelling stuff at you. Like, people don't experience that. There's like a limited number of people in the world that actually get to experience that.
Yeah. We were talking about yesterday. I was with my grandparents because Brad Davison at Wisconsin works out with me.
I love him. He's awesome.
And Brad might be the most hated basketball player in the country right now. And I love Brad. I would let Brad marry my sister. That's how much I love Brad. And I understand that sometimes the optics aren't they're not looking the greatest, but they're playing at Minnesota. They're from Minnesota.
Yeah.
I'm sitting in the second row. His parents are sitting right in front of us. And I've never heard an arena boo so loud for a human being. I'll send you the video.
I love that.
It was awesome. Yeah. Like, he's going through the tunnel and it's, come on, Brad. Every time he touches the ball, they boo. And like, this is funny. I look at his social media. He's got people from Iowa that are commenting. He's like, he posts a Bible verse like Proverbs 4:27, and then someone will be like, Proverbs 4:27, don't punch an Iowa player in the bottom. Like, this is funny because you either follow him or he's so on your radar that you had to look him up.
Exactly.
To quote DJ Sackman, thanks for watching. Like, I love it. I got a kid that Drake Dobbs, he's at Eden Prairie. They're 25-0. He's going to Liberty next year. They're blowing up.
Yeah.
Last year, they're playing in the section final against Dawson Garcia, who's done USA basketball stuff, going to Marquette.
Yeah.
Playing against Prior Lake, and he comes out and he airballs his first shot. And they just start booing him. And I'm like, you do not want to do that. That is not what you need to do. And so Drake, like, obviously responds to that. Right, comes out cooking and they win the game, but I get a kick out of some of that stuff.
Exactly.
Well, I appreciate you coming on. Before we let you go, can you tell our listeners where they can find you on social media?
Yeah, so on Twitter it's at Daggs Basketball. On Instagram it's at Steve Daggs 0, and then you know, our website for, you know, kind of stay up to date with everything, it's just Daggs Basketball, DAGS basketball.com.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate you coming on. I'm sure that we could have a conversation that was a little less family friendly if we wanted to talk about some topics in the game of basketball, but of course. I appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me, man. I appreciate it. We got to do it again sometime.
Absolutely. That was Steve D'Agostino with Dags Basketball. Steve has done an excellent job within the training industry as he develops players all over the Northeast, and I'm really glad that we could have him on today. I want to take this moment to remind you to check out the Film Room if you haven't done so already. You can find the Film Room online at basketballcatalyst.com/filmroom. For all their updates, breakdowns, and everything Catalyst training, you can follow me on Twitter at ReedOuse, that's ReidOuse, and on Instagram at Coach Ouse. See you next week.